Good morning. So last week we did, in fact, talk about Abraham and Sarah and how God invited them to go on a journey and, in fact, led them to a place that they weren't sure about, but they trusted and had faith that God would get them where they needed to be. And so today I've promised to share my own personal faith journey and the ways in which God has shaped and interacted with me through the years that has brought me to where I am today. And I'm going to do that, but first I invite us to hear another call story, that of Moses, as shared with us in the third chapter of Exodus 1 through 12. Moses was taking care of the flock for his father-in-law Jethro, Midian's priest. He led his flock out to the edge of the desert, and he came to God's mountain called Horeb. The Lord's messenger appeared to him in a flame of fire in the middle of a bush. Moses saw that the bush was in flames, but it didn't burn up. Then Moses said to himself, "Let me check out this amazing sight and find out why the bush isn't burning up." When the Lord saw that he was coming to look, God called to him out of the bush, "Moses, Moses." Moses said, "I'm here." Then the Lord said, "Don't come any closer. Take off your sandals because you are standing on holy ground." He continued, "I am the God of your father, Abraham's God, Isaac's God, and Jacob's God." Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, "I've clearly seen my people oppressed in Egypt. I've heard their cry of injustice because of their slave masters. I know about their pain. I've come down to rescue them from the Egyptians in order to take them out of that land and bring them to a good and broad land, a land that's full of milk and honey. A place where the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites all live. Now the Israelites' cry of injustice have reached me. I've seen just how much the Egyptians have oppressed them. So get going. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." But Moses said to God, "Who am I to go to Pharaoh and to bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" God said, "I'll be with you, and this will show you that I'm the one who sent you. After you bring the people out of Egypt, you will come back here and worship God on this mountain." This is the word of God for all God's people. Thanks be to God. Will you pray with me? May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable to you, Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. So, in order to share my faith story with you this morning, I'm going to share four events from the early part of my life that have most influenced me and reveal how God has been working in my life. But before I do that, I need to share a little bit about my own origin story. I am originally from Asheboro, North Carolina, and I am the youngest of four children. I have three older brothers. So I know some of you right now are thinking, "She is a spoiled brat." And I beg to differ with you on that point. I would argue that having three older brothers taught me really important life lessons, like how to grab the chicken leg before anyone else at Sunday dinner, and how to get a word in edgewise when you're part of a loud and boisterous family that's not going to wait to hear what you have to say. You have to get your voice heard. And how to have tough skin. Because the rule of thumb at our house is that my brothers couldn't hit or roughhouse with me like they did with one another. So what they couldn't do physically, they did verbally. And they would figure out how to push my buttons and get under my skin, and I had to practice and learn how to let that just roll off of me. Tough skin. But I also learned what fierce, protective love looks like. And I imagine that part of God's love for us looks a little bit like my brother's love for me. And I wouldn't give anything for the life I've had growing up with my three older brothers, whom I adore. Now, my mom was a nurse and my dad was a doctor. They met when he was in medical school at Chapel Hill. He was a family doctor. And so after the third child was born and was once again a boy, my dad really wanted a girl. So my mom said to him, "Wayne, one more child, one more. So I don't care what we do. If you want to guarantee your odds, I'm happy for us to adopt a little girl, but one more." So he goes and does research to figure out, all right, what decision do we make here? And he finally decided that their odds were pretty good. And so he said, all right, let's do this. And so my mom gets pregnant. And of course, back then, you didn't know the gender of the child until the baby was born, right? And so it was a day of great celebration when the Thompson household finally had a little girl. They were so excited that in spite of me being bald for the first year of my life, they taped a bow on my head so everyone would know that I was, in fact, a girl. And so life was very, very good. Loved my family. And this takes me to the first event, which happened in the summer of 1975, 3 days before my fifth birthday. Every summer, my family would go to the beach. And when I say my family, I mean every single person I knew I was blood related to. So both sets of grandparents, my aunts, uncles, and cousins on both sides of the family. And part of that was our family wasn't so large, so we could accommodate that. But it was also because of my dad. He just had a way of bringing people together. We all got along and loved each other very much. And so on this one particular day, my family was going to go search for shells. And me and the other cousin that was young like me had to stay back because it was nap time in the afternoon. And so my mom's parents stayed with us at the cottage. But everybody else went looking for shells. And they found a sandbar that they crossed over to along with other folks and spent several hours. What they didn't realize is that the tide had unexpectedly come in faster than normal. And with that, also had formed a riptide. And so all of a sudden they realized that they were in trouble and they were going to have to swim back. What was ankle deep water was now over their head, and they were going to have to swim to get back to shore. And they had little kids with them, so it was a scramble to try and get everyone back to where they needed to be. Well, the other problem was they had my grandmother with them, my dad's mom, who didn't swim. And so my dad and my oldest brother, who was 16 years old at the time, were helping her to try and get across the channel there. And at one point, my dad passes her off to my brother, and that was the last time that anyone saw him. And in fact, it would be 3 days later before we even were able to find his body because of the riptide. No one realized that that was happening at that moment. Everyone was trying to get everyone safely to the shoreline. What they noticed, though, was a commotion off to the side. And so they went to see what was going on, only to discover that my grandfather, who had not gone to the sandbar with them, was found floating face down in the surf. And so we think that he had a heart attack. We don't really know what happened with him. But in that one moment, I lost both my father and my grandfather in seemingly unrelated accidents. And so my family was obviously devastated, trying to figure out how to put those pieces back together. And in the process of that serious loss for my family, two people had a major influence in my life. One of those was my mother, who chose not to remarry, and instead she put her focus and attention on raising us four kids. And in that process was just an example of resilient strength for me. Just was an amazing woman to watch navigate this incredible loss that she had. And she did a great job raising the four of us. The other thing that she did, which we didn't realize at the time, but she modeled for me this blurring of gender roles. And at the time was not exactly typical, but since she, you know, was essentially being raised by a single parent, she did everything. And so it was later that I looked back and realized, trying to understand who I was or why I was the way I was, and I realized that the example she had given me is that you just do what needs to be done, and just was a blurring of what had been typical gender roles and expectations. But the person who had the greatest influence and was the greatest support for me during that period and the years following was actually my grandmother. The person who lost both her husband and her only son that same day, who had every reason in the world to be angry at God and the world, wasn't. She just wasn't. And instead, she modeled for us a deep and abiding faith, a faith in God, that God would see her through this, that life was good and that God is good no matter what. And so, that was a gift for us to be able to see how she handled this. But the other thing she did for me was she provided a safe space for me to try and understand and figure out what had happened. If you spend any time around me, you will see I ask a lot of questions. I always have. And back then, I really was just trying to make sense of what had happened. I wasn't there when the accident took place, and I couldn't understand where my father was. And I can remember being at the dinner table, and I would start asking questions, and my mom would either start crying, or she would get up and leave, and my brothers would elbow me and tell me to shut up. And I just was trying to understand. But when I was with my grandmother, and I spent a lot of time with her, she always received my questions. And she didn't always have answers, right? But we would wrestle with those questions together. And every summer, I got the chance to spend a week with her just by myself, which was always very special. But we would have the best conversations, and she taught me that it is okay to ask these tough questions, and that no matter what we throw to God, God can handle it. And it was a great place to nurture and develop my faith. The other thing she did was plant some really important seeds about my understanding of God. She did that because every night when I would spend the night with her, we would read installments of the story of Moses. And I can remember crawling into that ginormous king-size bed, just feeling like I was completely lost in that. And she would read to me bits of the story every night. It was a rite of passage, by the way, the year that I got to read it to her. But I realized that I was hearing over and over and over this story about God who heard the cry of the Israelites, who heard the cry of Moses, and who responded every time, that God was connected and caring for those that were calling out to God. And so in this process of growing up and dealing with this tragic loss in my family, I learned how to deal with loss. I learned that it was okay to wrestle with God. And I began asking these really tough questions of theodicy, or it's a fancy name for why bad things happen to good people. And I've had lots of questions for God around that topic. It's a whole sermon for another day. But my elevator speech around that is related to my life, is that God did not take my father and grandfather that day. That was not an intentional act on behalf of God. And that I know now that when our heart breaks, God's heart breaks. And in the midst of all of this loss, I also know that God was with us through it all. God helped us walk through that incredibly difficult time in our lives. So I'll circle back to my father's story in a minute, but let's fast forward to the second event, my young teenage years. And I actually experienced loss again in about a 2-year span, lost 3 more family members, a cousin a little bit older than me and an uncle to cancer, and then my other grandmother, my mom's mom. And it got to the point where I was like, God, who's next? Right? Who's next? And I got unusually comfortable with death and with grief for someone so young. But I ended up learning how to grieve well. I also learned the valuable lesson that death is a natural part of life, and that with that comes this deep appreciation for life. Life is a gift, not to be taken for granted and to be lived fully. And those were all lessons that I realized later would serve me well in ministry, to be able to help walk with people through their own grief and loss. But as a teenager, it was pretty difficult to make sense of all of this. But there was a culminating moment when my uncle, we found out that my uncle had died. He had in many ways tried to step into the gap with the loss of my father, and even though he lived 3 states away, he would come for dance recitals, God bless him, for important ball games and events in the life of me and my brothers. And so we loved him dearly, and that was a devastating phone call we received early on a Sunday morning. And I said to my mom, I really need to go to church. She was a little surprised at my request, but she had one of my brothers bring me and pick me up. So I can remember sitting in the sanctuary of my home church that morning all by myself, thinking, there is nowhere else that I would rather be in this moment than right here. As I felt just this deep sense of peace overcome me, and the knowledge I was surrounded by a church family that loved me, that had been so important to us as we had navigated our loss, and to be in a place where I knew God's holy presence could be found. And I began to realize, maybe I have pretty strong feelings about the church and about God that people my age, I'm not sure my peers my age, felt the way that I did. And I noticed that, but I didn't think anything else about it. What I didn't notice is that God was putting a call on my life. But at that time, I couldn't see it. I couldn't recognize that quite yet. And so let's fast forward to event number 3 in college, which is probably very familiar to many of us. It's the career crisis, right? So I went to Carolina with the plan of becoming a doctor, just like my dad, right? I wanted to follow in his footsteps. And while I loved biology, I hated chemistry. And so by my sophomore year, I realized this is not my path. Right? I need to figure out what my path is, because this is not it. And so I did the career counseling, and in that process began to really think about what are the aspects of my life that are life-giving, that I love, that I enjoy. And I realized almost every answer went back to my activity and participation in the Wesley Foundation at Chapel Hill, which is the United Methodist Campus Ministry, just like we have here at App. And I decided it was time for me to go and talk with the campus minister, Manuel Wortman. By the way, Manny was here last Sunday. They were on vacation, and he realized this was my first Sunday, and it was a great surprise to be able to spend some time with him. But when we went to have lunch, he said, well, first of all, I was wondering when you were going to ask to have this conversation. And I realized he had seen something in me that I couldn't see in myself. But we had the conversation about what does it take to go into ministry? How does that work? Talk to me about this. And he said what all of us say to people that are asking this question. If you can do anything else with your life, do it. But then he added this phrase onto it. He said, because the church needs more strong lay people than it does strong clergy. And I thought, that's a weird thing to say. But now being in ministry all these years, he's exactly right. What he meant by that, and what the truth of it is that a church can only go so far with a strong pastor and a strong clergy team. But a church that also has strong laity, deeply faithful laity, and strong clergy team can literally do anything that God asks of them. Anything. And so after I prayed about what he'd said to me that day, I realized I was being called into vocational ministry, that this was what I needed to do with my entire life. And so I decided I needed to grow up a little bit and do something else for a few years before going to seminary. So I graduated from the School of Public Health and became a health educator. It was a beautiful combination of health allied field as well as social work. And so I loved it. Those 2.5 years, I got to come back home, save money, and live at home and prepare for seminary. And in that process, something strange began to happen to me. Now, I knew that my dad had been an amazingly wonderful person, but you have to understand, I only had 3 memories of my own of him from my childhood. Everything else I've constructed from what other people have told me about him. Well, when most of those stories come from your family and you have something like tragic like that happen, people, of course, remember all of the good things, right? And so I knew the story I had in my head was probably a little bit more positive than was reality. But I would be out and about in town, and I would have folks either recognize me or my name and say, "Are you Dr. Thompson's daughter?" And then would go on to tell me something I had not heard about my father. And I thought, at first was really strange. And then I began to appreciate those conversations, like the one I had in the grocery store checkout one day. And I was paying for my groceries with this antiquated thing called a personal check, where I also had to hand my driver's license over. And I can remember her name. It was Dottie. And when she saw my picture and my name, she looked up at me square in the eyes and said, "Are you Dr. Thompson's daughter?" I said, "Yes," knowing what was getting ready to happen. And she stopped and said, "I remember exactly where I was when I heard on the radio that Dr. Thompson had drowned." And she said, "He was the best doctor that I ever had." And she got teary-eyed and for 5 minutes just started talking about how wonderful my dad had been to her. And I realized this is something else going on here, that this man had really had a positive impact on people's lives and in this community. And so it caused me to go do a little bit more research. And what I discovered is that when my dad was in college, he was wrestling with a call into ministry. Is it medicine or is it ministry? Well, he chose medicine, but he treated it like his ministry. And that was why he was so beloved in that community. And I realized or just prayed and longed for, if I could just have a fraction of the love and compassion and positive impact that he had on his surrounding community, if I could just have a fraction of that in my ministry, then I knew my ministry would be fruitful. And the other thing that I took from that has meant all the world to me is I realized that I had a spark within me that was part of my dad. That while my mom helped give me strength, my dad helped give me this deep faith and this spark of a calling to be able to serve and be faithful to God. And so I'm so grateful to be able to carry that within me. So I went on to seminary at Candler in Atlanta at Emory University and loved being in Atlanta. And this takes me to the fourth and final event, which happened the week of my ordination. Now, you'd think that after all this discernment and affirmation that I'd be square, ready to go, right? But that's not the case, and this happens a lot in our faith journeys as we have moments of assurance and moments of doubt. And that particular week, well, there's no other way to put it. I just had a flat-out meltdown. And I was all by myself because all of my colleagues from North Carolina, most of them went to Duke. So I had very few friends at that point in time. And so I am going through this crisis of, I cannot do this. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm not good enough. I'm not the person, God, you thought I was. I was just freaking out, and I was processing this by myself, which is never good. Well, if you've ever been to Junaluska, you know one of the things that folks do is to walk or run around the lake there. And I was doing that once, sometimes twice a day. The other thing I remember is it was a prolific duck year. There are always ducks at Lake Junaluska, but this year there were baby ducks everywhere. And I soon noticed that there was always this little girl somewhere. She was at different places around the lake, but every time I went around the lake, I would see her. She had long brown hair and these big glasses. And she was always feeding the ducks, or she'd have her toes in the water surrounded by ducks. And so I just found it a little curious. On Friday, when the plenary session was ending, everybody was making their way back up to the auditorium in what's called the Rose Walk there at the lake. And I look up, and there's this little girl, and she is like a salmon swimming upstream. And I notice her because she's very agitated and upset. And she keeps peering over the little fence, because at the Rose Walk, there's about a 6-foot drop before the water. And I was really concerned that she was going to try and climb over that fence. And I thought, what is she looking at? And so I look down over the fence at the water, and sure enough, there's one little baby duck just swimming as hard as its little feet would paddle it all by itself. So when I finally catch up to the young girl, I ask her, is she okay? What's going on? And she said, this little baby duck has lost its family, but I know who it belongs to. I know where its mommy is. If I can just capture and grab that little duck, then I can take it back to its family where it belongs. I know all of the ducks. I've been watching them all week. I know where this duck belongs if I can just get to it. And I was like, sure, right. You know exactly where this duck goes. But I stayed with her because I didn't want her to get hurt. And thankfully, the duck was making its way to where the shoreline flattens out. Well, before I could get the sentence out, you might want to go slow and be quiet because you don't want to scare the duck away from you. She had taken off, run around the corner, scooped that duck up, had it in his hands, and just turning around, looking at me with the most beautiful expression. I can't even describe the look on her face. She says, I've got it. I've got the duck. Now I'm going to go and take it back to its mom. And she was gone, just like that, lost in the crowd. And I didn't see her again the rest of that weekend. So I was sitting there going, all right, God, what just happened here? How do I make sense of this story? And as I reflected on it, I figured one of two things might be going on here. First of all, maybe God was trying to say to me that I'm the little duck, right? Feeling like I'm all alone. I'm swimming. I'm struggling all alone. And God is this little girl who never took her eyes off of that duck and was ready to scoop the duck up and restore it where it needed to be at just the right moment. And that this was a reminder that even though I felt all alone in that moment, I wasn't. Or maybe God was saying, you're the little girl. And that duck represents the churches that you will serve in the future or the people that you will have a chance to care for who are struggling with life. And it was just this little glimpse of my future ministry and a reminder of my own persistence and love and compassion for others and an assurance that it is going to be okay. My hunch is I was probably supposed to hear both of those messages. By the time Saturday's ordination rolled around, I had found my calm center again, and even though I was still nervous and a little bit anxious, I had been reminded once again that God was indeed with me and it was going to be okay. Well, that lesson really took about 8 years into ministry before I finally was able to grab hold of it and keep it, to have the assurance that when life went sideways, that indeed God was still present with me, and so that now that is unwavering for me. But it took a while, and in that process, as I was growing into my own calling, I figured out that my job is pretty specific as I answer God's calling. The first is that I am to take care of my soul by nurturing my relationship with Jesus. I have to do that first and foremost, or nothing else really matters or works. Secondly, I have to model loving neighbor, because that is what Jesus called us to do. And I have to model loving my neighbor in all of the ways that that can take place. And then I need to really practice the art of discernment, so that I'm constantly listening for what the Holy Spirit has to say in my own life, but also in the life of the church, for the community of believers. And then, with strength and courage, to act on what it is that I've heard. When I'm doing those things, then I am able to be the vessel, the instrument that God has called me to be. And that's what my ministry is about, is being God's instrument in God's kingdom work. So to summarize kind of the lessons from these many life events that have shaped and formed me and my relationship with God, a reminder that God is ever present with us. Even in those desert places, God is present with us. And even in those highs, the best, beautiful, joyful moments of life, God is present with us. And also that God calls everyone to something. God calls all of us to something. And with that calling, God never calls us to something without providing what we need to do what God is asking of us. And then finally, when I allow God to be in control, then it's amazing to see what God will do. When I forget that lesson, things can go amok. But when I allow God to be in control, it is a beautiful, beautiful thing. So maybe you noticed in my story, there's no mountaintop experience, right? There's no one mountaintop spiritual high. Instead, my story is an example of a persistent presence of God in and throughout my life. And that's still happening. So many things have happened even since my young call into ministry, that God is persistently present and reminding and loving on me. And it is my unique call story. Just like Moses' story is his unique call story, and the disciples, they have their own unique call story, and friends, so do you. You have your own unique faith story. So my hope is that two things have happened this morning as you have patiently listened to me. One, that you've got the chance to get to know me a little bit better. And two, that you've been thinking about your own faith story. And my hope is that you will take a moment, sometime maybe today or at least this week, and share your faith story with someone else, with a friend or a family member, but to share your own unique story. And as you're thinking about that, I hope you will answer three questions. One, who is it that God is calling you to be? Who is God calling you to be? Secondly, what might God be calling you to do? Is there something that God might be nudging or calling you to do? And third, and most importantly, what is your answer? How do you respond to what you're hearing from God? My hope, my prayer for you, is that like Moses, you respond, I'm here. I'm here, God. Amen.